From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Democrats and Republicans are still divided over what Robert Mueller said in his statement yesterday as he shut down the Russia investigation. The president tweeted, case closed. But Democrats heard Mueller telling them to open further investigations since he was blocked by Department of Justice rules. Well, Mueller was clear about one thing. The Russians interfered in 2016.
And I will close by reiterating the central allegation of our indictments that there were multiple systematic efforts to interfere in our election. And that allegation deserves the attention of every American.
Well, today the president seemed to admit that Russia interfered. He tweeted, quote, "The reports showed I had nothing to do with Russia helping me to get elected." Say what? Reporters took that to mean that in bragging about no collusion, the president unwittingly said Russia helped get him elected. But he backtracked.
No, Russia did not help me get elected. You know who got me elected? You know who got me elected? I got me elected. Russia didn't help me at all.
And the president has supporters in that. Here's Fox News Tucker Carlson last night after playing a clip of Mueller describing election interference.
Well, that sounds compelling and terrifying. But is it actually true? Have we really proved that?
He went on to conclude, no. Lawrence Norden is deputy director of the Democracy Program at the Brennan Center for Justice. They're monitoring election security. Lawrence, first, your reaction. Carlson and his guest weren't talking about collusion. They were talking about whether Russia even interfered. We remember President Trump saying he asked Putin, and Putin said they didn't. Carlson and others still saying that as well.
It's simply wrong. The intelligence community is unanimous in its conclusion that the Russians interfered in the 2016 election. And not only that, they are unanimous in their concern that they'll be back. Finally, it's not just Russia at this point that we have to worry about. And in fact, we just got a report out yesterday that tied Iran to election interference in 2018. So not only is there unanimity in the conclusion from those who have really studied this issue that Russia interfered in 2016, there's also a concern that a Pandora's box has been opened and that we're going to see much more of this in 2020.
All right, this is what we want to do in the next couple of minutes. Take a look at what the concerns are. Where are we on preparing for 2020 and, you know, holding at bay both Russian and other interference?
Well, first of all, I just want to take a quick step back. When we talk about Russian interference in the 2016 election, we're really talking about three separate things. The first was hacking of election campaigns and leaking that information. The second was a social media disinformation campaign. And the third was attacks on election infrastructure. We've made progress on all three fronts, but we definitely have a lot more that we need to do ahead of 2020, in particular on the election security front. And the president himself actually raised this today. We still have voting machines that don't have paper backups, which is a real concern. And we have aging equipment around the country that really presents an election security concern. So there are steps that we should be taking to secure that election infrastructure.
We'll start right there because you quote people from different voting areas saying their machines are aging out. They can't even get parts and they can't afford to replace the machines, even though there's been some federal money.
Yeah, we did a survey just this spring. Local election officials in 31 different states told us they need to replace their equipment before 2020. And the majority of them don't have the money to do that. And that's particularly a concern when you don't have a paper backup. If you have machines failing and you need to go back and kind of reconstruct what happened and assure people that all votes were counted, that's difficult to do if you don't have a paper backup.
Yeah. And you talk about making sure that there are post-election audits, you know, having these kinds of election security priorities. But you talk about the other ways that the Russians interfered with the 2016 election. Social media campaigns, for instance, turning Americans on each other, taunting one particular ethnic group, pretending to be another ethnic group and getting them all embroiled. How do you prevent that?
Well, that's very difficult, obviously. I think one thing is just public education. Another is that the social media companies themselves have to make more of an effort getting rid of fake accounts. And finally, for paid political ads, it is illegal for foreign nations to direct others or to purchase themselves political ads. And we need to strengthen the laws to prevent that from happening.
And again, we want to talk more about this as we get closer to 2020. But meantime, Lawrence, what do you do about people who are making a determined effort to say it's not happening, Tucker Carlson among them?
That's a real problem. At the very least, we should have agreement on the facts. And in this case, I think the facts are overwhelming that there was interference. And if we close our eyes to it, we're going to be in for an ugly surprise in 2020. I think a lot of people that are working in elections are working very hard to increase our defenses against this. And that's the good news. But, you know, you don't just have to look at the United States. You look at Ukraine, other Eastern European countries. The Russians and others have devoted a lot of resources to interfering in our elections. And there's a real danger if we can't have a common set of facts around this issue and ensure confidence in our elections. It's what the foundation of our democracy rests on.
Lawrence Norden, Deputy Director of the Democracy Program at the Brennan Center for Justice. We'll talk more about election security. But Lawrence, thank you for today.
Thank you.
Well, today, New Hampshire repealed the death penalty. The state's Senate voted to override a veto from earlier this month by Republican Governor Chris Sununu. Last week, the New Hampshire House voted to do the same. For more on this, let's bring in Josh Rogers, senior political reporter at New Hampshire Public Radio. He's in Concord. Hi, Josh.
Hi, Jeremy.
And New Hampshire has had some form of the death penalty since the 1640s. How significant is what happened today?
Well, the veto overrides were expected. The margin was very narrow. And, you know, this is quite significant for the main actors on both sides of this issue. You know, the activists, and they really do come from both political parties, who believe capital punishment is wrong, either morally or that it gives the state too much power. And, you know, for those on the other side of this, this is rather disappointing. I mean, and those are mostly, at least the out front folks, are members of law enforcement and police unions. And, you know, for them, this has been an important issue for a long time. And, you know, they're seen as important politically. And so they've tended to find allies in the corner office in terms of keeping the state statute on the books. And, you know, that's helped inform how governors here have tended to view capital punishment. And, you know, no one's been put to death here in such a long time that you know, there's not even a death chamber in our prison. So the debate has become a little bit divorced from the reality of putting people to death. And, you know, there is now somebody on death row, and that has changed that.
Right. There's one inmate on death row, Michael Addison, who killed a Manchester police officer back in 2006. What will happen to him now?
Well, that's a good question. Many people think that this veto override, while the law repealing the death penalty was written as prospective, that, you know, this override's going to affect his sentence, and that it certainly opens up a new angle for him to fight his death sentence and potentially get that commuted to life in prison. You know, and backers of the retention of our current law certainly were raising that as a reason to support the governor's veto.
Okay, well, let's listen to some of the debate on this topic in New Hampshire, because it's been pretty emotional on both sides. This is from the Senate floor today. Here's Republican Senator Bob Gaida in favor of repeal.
Anyone that has watched an execution by lethal injection, many of which go awry, are treated to a ghastly sight. I think we're better than that.
Okay, and here's Republican Senator Sharon Carson, who supports the death penalty.
We just don't execute people for no reason. We have a very well-crafted statute that the people of the state of New Hampshire get to make that decision. I don't want to take that decision away from them. And I also want to protect our police officers. So they know that if they are murdered in the line of duty, that they will receive justice as well.
So some emotional debate there on both sides. What's the reaction today to the repeal of the death penalty in New Hampshire?
Well, for backers of the repeal, it was quite emotional. I mean, this has been a long time coming for them. They've been pushing for this for, you know, about 30 years at this point. You know, the legislature did once send a repeal bill to a governor in the 1990s. That was then governor, now Senator Jean Shaheen. She vetoed that repeal. And, you know, it took until just last year to get another repeal to a governor's desk. And, you know, Governor Sununu vetoed that and immediately promised to keep fighting and to keep the death penalty here. And so for supporters of capital punishment, you know, I think it's fair to say most saw the writing on the wall this year. Though, you know, again, this repeal was narrow. It passed. It got the 2/3 majority in the House by one vote, and it received the bare minimum to override the governor in the Senate. And, you know, for law enforcement types, and there were a lot of them around the statehouse before the vote, you know, they made themselves scarce afterwards. And, you know, the governor, he was leaning on people to help him keep the death penalty. Mm-hmm. And so this is a defeat for him, too.
Josh, as you know, there are a lot of presidential candidates hanging around your state right now. I wonder, do you think that now the death penalty is going to be an issue that they're all going to be asked about?
Well, I think it'll probably get raised. You know, criminal justice reform issues have been big among Democratic primary voters and certainly among the candidates. So I don't see that changing.
That is Josh Rogers, senior political reporter with New Hampshire Public Radio. As that state becomes the latest state to repeal the death penalty, overriding the governor's veto today. We'll keep following this story. Josh, thank you.
You're welcome, Jeremy.
Here and Now is supported by Daily Harvest. Daily Harvest delivers carefully sourced, chef-crafted smoothies, soups, harvest bowls, overnight oats, and more, all built on fruits and vegetables. Each single serving cup can be prepared in minutes. Daily Harvest is designed for convenience, so you can load up on fruits and vegetables first thing in the morning, before bed, and any time in between. Learn more about Daily Harvest and get 3 free cups in your first box when you go to dailyharvest.com and use promo code NOW. That's dailyharvest.com. Use promo code NOW.
Earlier this month, the Central Park School for Children, a middle school in Durham, North Carolina, invited 2 drag queens of color, Vivica Cox and Stormy Day, to come speak to the students about bullying after reports of LGBTQ students leaving the school because of bullying. Vivica, in particular, seemed a perfect choice. She oversees a drag troupe, but also is chair of Pride Durham, coordinating the different LGBTQ communities and the annual Pride Parade. And she practices what she calls social activism drag, reaching out to straight communities. Here she is at a lecture on drag.
So I hope you've had a very educational experience. They told me to keep it family friendly. I'm looking for children. I see at least one, so I will.
And Vivica joins us now. Vivica, adults are one thing, but what did you think about reaching out to kids in a middle school?
Well, first I was afraid, mostly because I remember my middle school experience, and I was thinking, what are these middle schoolers going to do to me? And then I realized I was an adult and I was no longer in middle school, and then I became excited to go in there and actually be a part of something so special.
Isn't that true? We are immediately the kids that we were when we get into an area that doesn't feel safe for us.
That is absolutely true. And especially if it reminds us of any bullying we experienced when we were in middle school.
Yeah. Well, so this is fascinating because, again, you've done tons of outreach. I'm sure you've come across uncomfortable situations as an adult. But going back into a middle school reduced you to that kid again. Talk a little bit about that. Why? What happened when you were in school?
Well, you know, I'm a chubby black kid with red hair, natural red hair, who was existing in a rural middle school in North Carolina, and people just didn't know what to do with me. I was called Skittles, and I was also called Prince because I was light-skinned. And folks had so much to say to me. And at some point, I kind of claimed my queerness before I realized I was queer. And when they would call me Skittles, I would always have responses like, you know, taste the rainbow, trying to make it positive instead of something super negative. And I guess it was the comedy inside of me that wanted to deflect. But it doesn't mean that I had a positive experience just because I found a way to make people laugh around it. And going back to a middle school and being queer in a middle school, it just brought up all of those different experiences for me.
There was a panel discussion. We know somebody from the city council was there. Some kids from the school put on a step performance that looked fantastic. And you put on a drag show. What did you try to convey to the kids?
When I was on the panel, I saw it as an opportunity to demonstrate to the students that you can be happy and have been through something. But more importantly, that everyone is deserving of happiness and capable of having love in their life. They deserve good things. And I wanted to be that example, someone who has been through something and came out on top. It doesn't matter all of the adversity I've faced. I want to be happy today. And that was the message I was putting forth on the panel.
And what about the fact that you were sitting there dressed as a woman with, you know, a full, again, we'll have pictures at herenow.org, but with a full bouffant hair and great eyeliner, I have to say.
Thank you.
But, you know, what, I mean, because this sexual identity is confusing enough for young people, right? Mm-hmm. And so here there was another element. I mean, did you differentiate between, you know, somebody who's gay or lesbian and then also somebody who does drag?
Well, the thing about Durham is we don't draw rigid lines. We don't tell someone because they do drag that they are presenting as a woman. We allow for the gender lines to be blurred. And I truly believe that young folks today are able to see the complexities of both sexuality and gender in ways that we weren't when we were coming through school. So when I got up there, I talked about being a performer and being a drag queen and having garnered some fame, but I didn't talk about who I am outside of drag. I talked about what it meant to grow up as a rural Black kid in North Carolina and how it feels to be where I was on that day.
What was their response?
I love talking about the responses of the students because most of them were so enthralled. There were rainbow flags in the audience. There was a group of folks who were ready to respond at every opportunity saying, yes, okay, honey, things like that, and really giving us all of the life that we wanted to get. But then, of course, there were some of those young boys who didn't want to be there, had their hoodies pulled over their faces, and wanted to feel like they could disappear. And we had a conversation with them about how this is an opportunity to see something new and learn and grow, and for them to remember they are seen, just like we are.
And yet, we have been, you know, hearing from students who felt empowered by it. Did you hear about that as well?
I did. The response after the event, when they were hugging us outside of the auditorium, was absolutely overwhelming. And to have parents who happen to be friends of mine or whose sibling is my friend or whomever finding me later, sending me emails saying, my neighbor's child, my cousin's child, my child was so empowered by this. When can we see the House of Cox again? We're so thankful you did this for our kids and our students. But since the event, I've received a couple of emails with concerning messages that it is terrible for students to be exposed to drag queens when I would argue the students disagree and that we're only exposing folks to a richer life and we're able to show folks what it means to be brave.
Can you understand, you know, people who just fear that students are maybe too young to process this or they might want to introduce these topics at home?
And I do hope folks do introduce them at home. I just hope other folks can see that someone who's been doing social justice drag is well-equipped to help them along on the journey. And I hope folks are introducing people at home sooner rather than later, if you will, so that we can have these conversations much more easily.
Mm-hmm. Vivica, thanks so much.
Of course. Thank you so much.
Vivica Cox, a drag queen of color in Durham, North Carolina. Well, we go overseas now for another gender issue at a summer music festival. For years, they've been criticized for male-dominated programs, but this year, one of Europe's most acclaimed is focusing on gender parity. Primavera Sound kicks off today in Barcelona, Spain, with a 50-50 gender lineup. Performers include Solange, Janelle Monáe, Miley Cyrus, Erykah Badu, but as Lucia Benavides reports, it's just one part of Barcelona's music scene that's committing to bringing more women on stage.
It's a Tuesday night, and Sala Bol in downtown Barcelona is packed with people. Many are sitting on the floor around the stage, watching three women perform a Buena Vista Social Club cover. Every 2 weeks, the club hosts a women-only open mic, organized by the grassroots collective Las Pibas Producen, the women produce. Rocío Rapoport is one of the founders of the group.
¿Qué es esto? Visibilización de mujeres e identidades disidentes en la industria musical.
Our objective is to make women and minorities in the music industry more visible, she says. The group hosts various events and collaborates with organizations across Barcelona. Growing up in Argentina, the three founders say they didn't see many women on stage. So Fernanda Alemán says they feel that's crucial to creating a culture of respect.
Como dicen en Argentina,
Argentina. Por ser minita, ¿tocas? No, por ser minita, no. Toco porque mis canciones están buenas.
She says she's often asked if she got on stage for being a girl. She replies, no, I got on stage because my songs are good.
Pink when you're blushing inside. Baby, pink is the truth you can't hide. Maybe pink like the folds of your brain. Crazy pink as we all go insane.
We felt that naturally the best music that has been done in the previous year was made by women.
Marta Pallares of Primavera Sound says last year's strong releases by women led to the festival's decision to make 53% of its lineup this year women. That's a first for an international festival with over 200,000 attendees and more than a dozen stages.
We are not going back to a pale, male and stale lineup. It's not only about being diverse only in gender, but also in sexual orientation, on the nationalities of the artists we have. It's being diverse in every possible meaning of the word.
The music industry has long been known for being a boys' club. This year, Berklee College of Music in Boston and the nonprofit group Women in Music published a study about women in the industry. It found that while more than half of female artists reported feeling excluded because of their gender, a majority of them said they were satisfied with their work. Becky Pryor was the lead author of the study and says festivals are especially important for musicians' careers. They're a big part of their income.
We also know that audiences are over 50% women, so it makes some sense that the people who are performing are somewhat reflective of the audience. But as far as I can tell, Primavera really is the first of the large international festivals to reach this milestone.
Yet the women from the Barcelona collective Las Pibas Producen are reserving judgment until they see what impact this year's Primavera Sound Festival will have. Lucía Svetlitsa is another of the group's founders.
Veo que está creciendo mucho esta lucha, digamos. Lo que sí es, bueno, esto de cuánto es por moda o marketing y cuánto es real porque entienden la problemática.
While she sees the drive for gender parity growing, she wonders how much of it is a trend and how much of it is real. It's not just about filling quotas, she adds. It's about changing the entire culture. For NPR News, I'm Lucía Benavides in Barcelona.
And this is Here Now.
Mitch McConnell has become a champion for conservatives. But back in the day, he once got support from groups like labor unions.
I marked it down as one of the worst things I've ever done in my life.
So you thought about it over the years.
Oh, I still think about it every time I see his face.
Mitch McConnell, a new series from Embedded. Subscribe now.
And a new report notes another milestone in the falling cost of renewable energy. The International Renewable Energy Agency found that renewable energy is now the cheapest option for new power generation throughout many parts of the world, and analysts expect the cost to continue to fall. Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure, has taken a look. Hi, Robin.
Hi, Robin Young.
So, Robin Farzad. So we're talking about wind, solar. How low has the cost gone and why?
Well, onshore wind and solar voltaic costs in particular, they're being clocked at between 3 and 4 cents per kilowatt hour in some regions with good sun and wind and regulatory openness. You talk about Chile, Mexico, Peru, and even Saudi Arabia and the UAE. I mean, one stat that really stood out for me in this report is the global weighted average cost of concentrated solar power generated electricity fell 26% just last year. You have a glut of supply. China just flooding the world with cheap solar inventory, with windmill capital. And this is all being put out there for better or for worse, and it's pushing costs down.
Yeah, and how does it compare to fossil fuels?
Yeah, according to the agency's report, if you look at projects set to be commissioned just next year, more than 3/4 of onshore wind and 4/5 of utility solar PV, in their words, should provide lower priced electricity than the cheapest new coal-fired oil or natural gas option. Again, that's striking. You could not have imagined that a decade ago.
Yeah. And you mentioned China, you know, which is driving down costs as it does with a lot of things. That also makes this more appealing. But do you still have the problem with solar and others that in places where there isn't wind and a lot of sun, it isn't as usable?
Sure. I mean, look, there is right now on the supply side, at least, and you talked about China, a glut of inventory that's going to help depress installation prices. And so you're going to see cycles of euphoria. And maybe when oil and natural gas prices drop, people are going to say, see, we told you that this couldn't be sustainable. But if you could have cleaner energies kind of as a baseline thing, like natural gas-fired coal plants that you would use sparingly when the sun don't shine, this is going to put a huge dent in the world's carbon budget regardless.
And, of course, people are calling for there to be a dent put in that budget, you know, to raise prices even artificially, so to drive people away from fossil fuels with global warming. But at any rate, what does this new report mean for businesses around the world as they think about the future and being competitive?
Yeah, the market is making decisions and making clean tech competitive, even without the full extent of, you know, regulatory or carbon tax suasion. There's so much disruption that's emanated from oil prices spiking 10, 11 years ago. That spurred development first in fracking and then alternatives to fracking in pipelines. And of course, that China juggernaut, I like to say that the future is so bright, we literally have to wear shades.
I say that to young people. Where does the U.S. stand in this? Is the U.S. behind the rest of the world?
It kind of is, and it's not progressing as rapidly with the Trump administration keen to give coal maybe one last chance. You also just saw, literally just saw the Undersecretary of Energy actually coin the term, quote, freedom gas. I'm quoting here, increasing export capacity from this gas project is critical to spreading freedom gas throughout the world by giving America's allies a diverse and affordable source of clean energy. And Robin, look, furthermore, the Assistant Secretary for Fossil Energy then extolled, and I'm quoting, molecules of U.S. freedom to be exported to the world, close quote.
I remember Freedom Fries. Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure, on prices dropping on alternative sources of energy around the world. We'll keep an eye on that. Robin, thank you.
My pleasure. Stay sunny.
Louisiana became the latest state this week to ban abortion after 6 weeks before most women know they're pregnant. Louisiana joins half a dozen other states that have recently passed similar laws. Let's look at what's happening in the context of what has happened in the past with historians Nathan Connolly and Brian Ballow, co-hosts of the weekly podcast Backstory. Welcome.
Hey, Jeremy.
Hey, Jeremy.
Okay, so let's go back to the beginning, because what we hear about abortion typically is what's happened in the last few decades. But what about abortion in early America, Nathan?
Well, we don't have any explicit references to abortion in, say, English language medical guides in colonial America. You get things, maybe recipes for things like restoring menstruation, for example, using herbs to stimulate women's periods, which often will then serve as aborticides. So imagine women who might drink a tea with an herb like savin or other kinds of herbs. In German language medical guides, there are slightly more direct references. Just to give you one example, Christopher Sauer has a book called Small Herbal of Little Cost, printed in Germantown in Pennsylvania. And just to be clear, about one-third of the population of women in Pennsylvania speak German, so this is not an incidental volume. But it really does describe how one will, quote-unquote, expel the dead fruit, right? So it's very explicit. And this is running, you know, these kinds of manuals through the late 18th century, all kinds of midwifery manuals, and really trying to find ways of giving women somewhat safer measures for basically ending a pregnancy. The other thing I'll say about this is we have very few personal accounts of abortion, but there are a few. And just one quick example, one woman named Coates Pashal, she's writing in the 1750s about an abortion she had maybe 20 years earlier. And she just uses, you know, really kind of gripping language about having, quote, very bad and violent pain in the back and bowels for 3 months with child. And then she's basically given a kind of herbal enema as a way to end the pregnancy. And it's seen as being, again, a way of ensuring women's health and not part of a larger effort to basically bring about autonomous women's actions in, say, the commercial arena.
And that was in the middle of the 18th century, as you said. But in 1821, Brian, Connecticut becomes the first state to ban abortion. How does that come about?
Well, it comes about through the really immoral and bad actions of a man, you'll be shocked to hear. And not only a man, but a minister. He was ministering to an older woman who was dying. And while doing that, he had an affair with that woman's granddaughter, 30 years younger. When the woman became pregnant that he was having an affair with, he insisted that she go through these herbal procedures to abort the fetus. When that did not happen, he resorted to mechanical abortion, actually using a device. That did not work immediately. She did eventually give a birth to a fetus that was stillborn, and by then he had beat it out of town. Now, folks in Connecticut were absolutely outraged by this behavior. And so when they went to try to prosecute this guy, they learned that there really were no laws on the book against this. And that's how we got this law in 1821. And what the law said was that it banned medicinal abortion, the kind that Nathan was just talking about, and it banned it after quickening. Quickening is when the mother could begin to feel movements on the part of the fetus, usually happening about midway through the pregnancy. And Connecticut was the first, but other states soon followed, New York in 1829 and a whole bunch of them after that in the 19th century.
And then once you get into the 20th century, but before Roe versus Wade, what was the state of abortion in the United States, Nathan?
Well, in the 1930s, you begin to see sharp increases in both legal and illegal abortions during the Great Depression. And you can obviously, you know, make some connections there again with women needing to participate more fully in the workplace and not wanting to be sidelined by a pregnancy or thinking about the dangerous health consequences, given the absence of safe health care for many women during that time. What's interesting, though, is even among working class women, there are almost identical rates of abortion among Catholic and Jewish and Protestant women, that there's no real religious breakdown, as one might imagine, given the problems that, you know, ethnic Catholic families might raise for their daughters seeking abortions or those kinds of things. And then, of course, there's the question of race, which is never far from the table, especially in the 1930s. You have one doctor, Edgar Bass Kiemer. He's a doctor from Detroit, and he has an abortion clinic that he runs between the 30s and the 70s, and he's really targeting black poor women for about 35 years, helping them get access to these abortion services. And again, because there's largely a denial of their access to white physicians. He performs over 30,000 abortions, and he basically makes the argument that when he was early in his career and denied a woman access to this, the woman turned around and committed suicide, and it made him somewhat of a crusader in this arena. Ultimately, he's actually tried and convicted for performing what is ultimately an illegal service at the time in mid-century. In 1950s, he goes to jail for about 14 months. Hmm. And rather than becoming a test case for the question of abortion rights for physicians more broadly, he ends up being race-baited through the proceedings when they're able to discover that he basically is performing some of these services on white women. So the idea of a black man touching a white woman's quote-unquote private parts is anathema before the courts. And so he really is given the harshest sentence possible at the time.
Interesting. Now, a couple decades after that, we get to the part of the story that everybody knows, which is Roe versus Wade, the Supreme Court case. It was a 7-2 opinion that said that basically abortion was a constitutional right. Brian, what was the response, the public response after Roe v. Wade?
Well, it was two-pronged, as you might imagine. There was great celebration on the part of women, but there was also a very organized effort that had begun before the decision, Jeremy, to push back by the Catholic Church. You know, polling showed that Catholics actually supported the decision being left to the woman and her physician by a slim majority, 64% of the overall population. In the immediate wake of the decision, Jeremy, actual support for the decision about an abortion being left to the woman increased. Within a few years, it was up to 67% of the American population.
So what do you make of what we're seeing now, and especially in the last decade or so, a huge spike in anti-abortion legislation, and especially in the last, you know, couple of months? Just it seems like it's happening very quickly now that there is a conservative majority on the Supreme Court.
Well, What I left out was what happened in politics. For starters, Richard Nixon, going back to his reelection campaign in 72, recognized that there were segments of the white ethnic population, that, quote, forgotten man that Nixon was trying to appeal to, that really would support right to life. And he began campaigning on this issue. It obviously took off under Ronald Reagan and his campaign for, quote, family values. And a man who went on to be very influential on this issue on the Supreme Court, Antonin Scalia, actually worked for Ronald Reagan and wrote a very important memo that laid out a strategy for beginning to win back the fight against abortion by going state to state. And that is very much where we are today.
And Nathan, do you think that, here we are in 2019, do you think that we're on the verge of seeing Roe versus Wade overturned by the Supreme Court?
What's interesting, I think, now is obviously the case law that, we're looking at is one in which you have certain cases in the 1990s, particularly Planned Parenthood of Southeastern Pennsylvania versus Casey, that's allowing the court to uphold abortion but still rewrite some of the standards of protection. So the struggle going forward will be about on what terms is abortion rights, if it is going to exist, going to be protected. So will there be more hurdles to jump, or will there simply be, an effort to try to make the standards that seem clearly articulated in Roe remain the law of the land? I mean, I think in some ways the concerns that were raised around Brett Kavanaugh being appointed to the court were seen as being, ground zero for what the anti-abortion fault lines will be in the next, 10 or 15 years. And I think in a similar way, what's happening in the electoral arena with more women arriving in the House and possibly even in the Senate in 2020, that's going to obviously create new sites of contestation on the abortion question going forward.
Although it was a woman, Senator Susan Collins, who made a very important decision that helped Brett Kavanaugh get onto the Supreme Court. So that's interesting as well. Nathan Connolly and Brian Ballow, historians and co-hosts of the weekly podcast Backstory. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
More than 3,000 refugees have relocated to Vermont over the last decade. For the most part, they've been welcomed by government officials and business leaders, in part because they help offset the state's shrinking population. But recent federal restrictions have limited the number of refugees who can come to the state, and other states are luring away at least one group. Vermont Public Radio's Bela Metzger explains.
In a nondescript building in Burlington's Old North End, upstairs from an Asian grocery store and down the hall from a shop filled with kids' clothes, there's a sparse office with big windows facing the street.
Hi. Good, how are you?
Bhuwan Sharma sits at a large wood desk with a stack of envelopes next to him. Thursday is payday. Every 15 minutes or so, someone walks through the door looking for their check.
Ram is here. Ram Rai.
Sharma co-owns Burlington Employment Agency, a temp firm that finds jobs for new Americans. All day, people stop by looking for work or for help with things like Social Security paperwork or housing applications, or just to gossip after picking up groceries downstairs.
It's almost like a big family working together, and that is something that we have consciously tried to do, and it works in our favor.
Sharma immigrated from Nepal. Many of his 80 clients are Bhutanese Nepali, the largest group of refugees in Vermont. They started arriving here about 10 years ago, from refugee camps in Nepal after being expelled from Bhutan during an ethnic cleansing. Today, more than 2,500 live in the Burlington area. Sharma saw a business opportunity in connecting them with local employers.
We took off from the word go when we started our business. We did very well from the first year.
But 3 years later, business has plateaued. Sharma says the biggest factor for this is that many of his clients are relocating from Vermont to Columbus, Ohio, home to the largest Bhutanese-Nepali community outside of Southeast Asia. Refugee advocates say more than 200 Bhutanese-Nepali refugees have left Vermont for Ohio in recent years. And that has state officials and local businesses concerned for two reasons. First, Vermont is an aging state with a low birth rate.
Lawmakers are so eager to draw new people to the state. This year, they started offering incentives to remote workers who move here. And second, the Trump administration's refugee policies have cut the number of new arrivals to the state to the lowest it's been in a decade. Put simply, Vermont doesn't want to lose anyone else.
You know, when you have an extended family pick up and move, that's, you know, anywhere from 5 to 10 to 15 employable adults that are leaving those jobs.
Emila Merjanovich heads the U.S. Committee for Refugees and Immigrants in Vermont. She says plenty of refugee groups have left Vermont for other states. But the declining rate of new arrivals makes this secondary migration a bigger concern.
And when our overall numbers are declining, there isn't sort of an equal out-migration and, you know, offset by new arrivals.
Vermont is not a bad place. I don't want to say that, really. It's a beautiful place.
Jumanat Acharya is a resettlement case manager in Columbus, Ohio. He helps new arrivals get set up. He's Bhutanese Nepali and has family in Vermont. But he says there's a gravitational pull to the Columbus area.
Most of the refugees, including Bhutanese refugees, the first thing they wanted to have is kind of, how can I become self-sufficient? Where is the best place that I can work and raise my family, where I can buy the house?
He says Columbus checks off a lot of the boxes. There are lots of manufacturing jobs that don't require employees to speak English, housing is cheap, and there's enough land so families can build homes to live near each other.
There is a tendency of staying closer to the family and friends because they will there's a sense of social support, you know, community support in any situation in hardships.
The city of Winooski, Vermont, has capitalized on the growth that comes with refugees. It's the state's most diverse city. More than 20 languages are spoken in its schools, and it's one of the few Vermont cities that's growing. But city manager Jesse Baker says Winooski is suffering from the drop-off in refugees.
People choose to live in Winooski because they like to be surrounded by culture and different languages and different perspectives. And if we see that wane, we are losing a strategic advantage we have as a community.
Businesses are concerned, too. Rhino Foods is a food manufacturer in Burlington. They make the cookie dough that goes in Ben & Jerry's ice cream. New Americans make up nearly 40% of their workforce. Caitlin Goss heads HR at Rhino. She says the company recently lost two longtime employees, Nepalese brothers, who moved to New York.
Not only might Rhino be losing two great employees, some of their family was working at other manufacturing companies down the road.
Back at the Burlington Employment Agency, even owner Bhuwan Sharma is exploring opportunities in Ohio.
If things slow down here, we have to make it up somewhere else, and that's a lucrative market, I guess.
For Here and Now, I'm Bela Metzger in Burlington.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.